This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, it's my pleasure to have another novelist on the show. His name is Joe Mino, and he's the author of lots of short stories and five novels, the latest being The Great Perhaps, which was a New York Times editor's choice. He teaches in the creative writing department at Columbia College in Chicago. Joe Mino, welcome to Progressive
Thanks.
Radio.
Thanks so much, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to meet you, and great to have the opportunity to read your novel. Part of my job now is reading novels. I don't get enough time on my own just to pick up a book and read it.
That's great. You get paid to do that.
Get paid to do it. It's better than paid to read the newspaper. I get paid to do that. That seems like a chore most days.
But yeah.
If I can read a novel and or read a book of poetry and get the author on the show, why, that's a bit of joy.
Well, I appreciate it.
Tell me how you got going in this creative writing field.
Well, originally, you know, when I was 18 or 19, I went to school down at U of I in Champaign, and I had grown up and I was in love with writing, but nobody in my neighborhood, I grew up on the South Side in Chicago, nobody really read books. Everyone's parents were, you know, either firemen or cops, teachers. And so the idea of being a fiction writer seemed like about as realistic as being an astronaut or something like that. And so I went down to school at U of I and took a bunch of classes, and I knew I was interested in storytelling and narrative, and so I took all these film classes. And then just on a fluke, I tried to get into a film class. I couldn't get into it, so I took a fiction writing class, and I just fell in love with the form, and I realized everything I wanted to do with film, with characters, I was able to do on the page without having to worry about actors or budgets or any of that stuff.
And how did your parents react when you said, I want to be a writer?
My dad, who is a stone and steel fabricator, third generation, I worked, you know, in high school with him. He said, all right, well, that sounds good. You just have to find a way to support yourself, you know. And I really actually admire him for that. I worked my way through college and grad school, and it forced me to try out a lot of different kinds of writing because of that. So I did, you know, music journalism, or I wrote restaurant reviews. And I think it's really good as a fiction writer to be forced to look beyond just your own imagination or invention and make connections between nonfiction writing as well, because usually that's what pays the best.
No, but it pays great. Yeah. I'd love to be a restaurant reviewer sometime.
Yeah,
how
right
was
there.
That? Was
it's,
that fun?
It's great. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, and, you know, writing about things you're excited about is a joy, and you can't believe you're getting paid, whether it's a restaurant or a record or a film.
I'm a picky little bastard. The restaurants would hate me when they saw me walking the door, I'm afraid. But
I worked in a lot of restaurants in college. I worked at a Shoney's. Do they have a Shoney's up here? No?
You know, I've heard of Shoney's.
It's like
I've
a chain.
Never eaten there.
Yeah, it was rough. It was a rough experience. It was on the far north side of Chicago, and there was a lot of group homes of recently released mental patients, and so that was mainly our clientele, and so they weren't the best tippers, but I got a lot of great stories from that experience.
Well, I can imagine. And when did you start feeling like you can make a go of this and you don't have to do plan B?
Never. I mean, never. I still, you know, have the best day job in the world, which is I teach creative writing at Columbia, and I've been there for about 10 years.
That's Columbia College in Chicago?
Yeah, in Chicago. It's the
largest. And why is that a great job?
Well, right now it's the largest fiction writing department in the country, and it's kind of the most progressive and I think most interesting. And we have open admissions for undergrads, so that means I get students in my writing classes who wouldn't be at any other school in the country or the world. And because of that, those students are forced to write stories that are compelling, but not just speaking to the issues or questions of some small group.
So it's not Iowa Workshop stuff.
It's not. No, it's very unconventional, and we're always kind of focusing on what's most interesting instead of looking at what's negative in young emerging writers' work. Mm-hmm. So I love it. I can't believe I get paid to do it. And I feel like I learn as much from just being in that environment and talking about writing as hopefully my students do.
I'm speaking with Joe Mino, who, aside from teaching creative writing at Columbia College in Chicago, has written a lot of short stories and five novels, including The Great Perhaps. You know, there's a hackneyed old cliche of a controversy over creative writing, whether it can be taught at all or whether you're wasting your time because either you've got the gift or you don't. How do you come out on that?
Well, I think it's practice. You know, if you want to be a great saxophone player, the best way to be a saxophone player is spend 7 or 8 hours with that instrument, you know, in the room by yourself. And so I feel like writing is practice. And that's something we really try to get into the heads of our students over and over again, is that the best way to write a good short story is write 9 really bad ones, and that's how you learn. And that's exactly how my experience has been, in that I think if someone has a curiosity, that to me is just as important as some natural talent, in that I've seen students who are incredibly talented but don't want to work or don't necessarily have the discipline. And it's a discipline. It's, you know, you sit in front of a computer for a couple hours a day every day, and it's not the most glamorous or illustrious job. And so really I feel like that ability to commit yourself and work and really like kind of relish in making mistakes and enjoying making mistakes and learning from those mistakes, that's the way writers develop.
And Joe, you know, this whole question of natural talent is up in the air, it seems to me, because, you know, maybe John Keats and Shakespeare were born with it. I don't know.
But I think,
you know, I bet they had people, you know, pushing them
one
way or another.
Yeah, just a mentor to say, here, read this book. Oh, that's interesting. You're doing this real interesting thing on your own. Here's someone who did something similar. And so having a mentor or teacher to lead you in a direction to point out this is what's working, and here's some other people who asked similar questions or did some similar things stylistically. You know, so much of your work as a writer is teaching yourself because you're reading a lot, and you can't be a good writer without reading. But having someone inform you or helping you make those choices is I think, is really helpful too.
I'm speaking with Joe Mino. His latest novel is The Great Perhaps. He teaches creative writing at Columbia College in Chicago. Tell me about The Great Perhaps.
Well, I started the book in 2004. In 2004, I was working for this great progressive arts and culture magazine called Punk Planet. And I think I was in my late 20s, early 30s. And it was the first time I had been so involved in politics as an adult. And we at the magazine had worked very hard trying to get John Kerry elected. Not so much because we were excited by John Kerry, because I don't know if anyone was actually excited by John Kerry, but we were just so just ashamed of the first 4 years of the Bush administration. And having never been so involved in a political moment, I had also never been so disappointed by the results of that election. And I started writing the book just a few weeks after that 2004 presidential election as a way to try to come to some understanding about what was going on in the country at the time. I had kind of come of age in the 90s and felt like the country was moving in this really interesting progressive direction. And then suddenly, within just a few years, it suddenly felt like we were almost in the Middle Ages. It had this very medieval quality.
Mm. And man, I was saying at the time, the Age of Enlightenment is over.
It was gone. Yeah. And it was pervasive. You know, it was pervasive. And the biggest tone was the sense of fear, or at least that's what I was aware of. That, you know, that was a big part of how Bush was reelected, was through these kind of fear tactics about mentioning gay marriage, or anytime his poll numbers dipped, then suddenly the terror alert went off, or, you know, they suddenly miraculously found some terror suspect. And it worked.
You injected that into this book, Joe Mino, because you have the parents. This is about a dysfunctional family. Mm-hmm. Let me just establish that at the outset.
Yes, it's true.
But the mom, you know, on election night when she sees that they're losing, you know, asks herself, why does it matter who wins the results? No matter who's named president, it'll probably be the same outcome. And she answers, because it does matter. Because among the things that two men share, there's a world of difference, significant and immutable differences. It's not a small, simple, meaningless decision.
And it felt like that maybe in 2000, or at least maybe on my part. You know, there was not such a great divide between Gore. Now we know, of course, but Gore, after his failed candidacy, was not the Gore of that 2000 election. And Bush, people weren't sure about, and, you know, he had a little more charisma. But
it was
no,
like Clinton, Bob Dole. I never thought there was a big difference.
Yeah.
Cataclysmic difference.
Yeah. There, it was clear. It was very clear. But in the 2000, so no one really knew what a huge shift this was going to be for the country. But in 2004, we had already had 4 years. I think that's what was so upsetting about the results is that we had seen the way the country was going. We had seen how their foreign policy. I think it's just problematic on so many different levels when someone says you're either with us or against us. And that question of fundamentalism or dogma isn't just a political one. It's something that's really haunted the first 10 years of this century. This idea of you're with us or you're against us, and whether you're talking about politics, you're talking about religion, you're talking about science. And so that's really the question of the book. The book is about these five family members. They live in Hyde Park, Chicago, which is, the neighborhood where the University of Chicago is in Chicago. And each in their own way, these five members are struggling for some sort of simple answer. You know, Jonathan, who's the father, is this paleontologist. And more than anything, he's spent 20 years trying to find this one species of squid that's going to help him prove the theory of evolution. And his wife, Madeline, is an animal behaviorist, and she's doing this study with social birds, with pigeons, and trying to understand dominance. And their daughter Amelia is 17 and has suddenly decided she's a Marxist and goes around with these kind of revolutionary ideas. And then their youngest daughter, Thisbe's 14, and even though she's raised without any religious background, has suddenly converted to this very, very rigorous Christianity where she goes around baptizing animals in her neighborhood.
And she has a lesbian infatuation.
She does. She develops this relationship that she doesn't quite understand with this other girl. And then there's the grandfather, Henry, who's in a retirement home, who's really trying to negotiate these terrible memories he has of his relationship to the country over the course of his lifetime. So what they all want is one simple answer. And by the end of the book, they each in their own way come to realize that what makes life interesting or beautiful is the complexities, the moments where life is complicated, and that to try to understand all of the different facets of life through one simple idea is always a mistake.
I'm speaking with Joe Mino. He is the author most recently of the great Perhaps. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine, and you're listening to Progressive Radio. Do you mind just giving us a sample?
Yeah, I would love to. So this is just from the first part of the book. The family takes a ill-fated trip to the zoo, and this is just a few weeks before the 2004 election in October. Today, it happens when the family goes to the zoo. Behind the wheel of the ancient silver Volvo, Jonathan has forgotten to take his anti-seizure medication, and because of this, the atom-sized world of his family will soon be upset. Madeline, his wife, doesn't seem to have noticed anything might be wrong. She looks happy sitting there in the passenger seat, staring out the window, humming. Their teenage daughters Amelia and Thisbe are both silent in the back seat. The sun is bright and glorious, a lovely Sunday afternoon at the beginning of October, a month of indecision. Though there haven't been any acts of terrorism lately, everyone is still doubtful about everything. The upcoming presidential election is a month away while the war in Iraq continues on without much hope. There are billboards and ads with political slogans suggesting this uncertainty everywhere. Dad, I was thinking, Thisbe, his youngest, calls from the backseat. Yes? I don't think I want to see the lions or the tigers. They make me want to cry. Jonathan raises his eyebrows, scratching at his beard, looking over at Madeline to respond. He glances in the rearview mirror and sees Thisbe, 14, in a plaid outfit and red sweater, her brown hair hanging in her dark eyes, looking sulky. "We don't have to see any animals you don't want to," Madeline says, "but I bet you'll change your mind when we get there." "I don't know if we should go to the zoo at all. I think it's cruel," Thisbe says, definitely moody.
"It's not cruel," Jonathan says. "It's educational. I used to go to the zoo with my father all the time. It's normal. It's what normal families do. They go to the zoo and tell their dads how lucky they are for being their daughters, and then they make up songs about how great their dad is. Doesn't that sound like fun?"
Thisbe just huffs, turning back to pout, staring out the window. "I don't think God likes the idea of zoos," she says. Jonathan smiles. Beside him, his wife shakes her head, rolling her eyes. Thisbe, a high school freshman, raised without a religious background of any kind, has begun to make bold arguments on behalf of God.
To Jonathan, it only seems like a silly, though perfectly natural thing for a teenage girl to do, struggling to find answers to the compromising mysteries of her young life. "I don't want to go to the zoo either," Amelia adds. Jonathan frowns, glancing in the rearview mirror once more. Amelia, a junior in high school, age 17, is wearing that awful black beret again. Amelia has recently declared herself a Marxist. Though she is white and whiter than most, with her mother's pale skin, chestnut hair, and sad, haunting blue eyes, Amelia has begun to wear t-shirts featuring the likenesses of Che Guevara, Malcolm X, and others, with slogans like, "No more prisons." Sitting at the dinner table in their expensive little home, Amelia has begun to mention revolution, with strange facts like, "Did you know the CIA totally admitted to killing members of the Black Panthers and nobody even cared?" "I think the zoo is totally bourgeois," Amelia says. Jonathan smirks, silently pleased by his oldest daughter's growing political intelligence. He's also a little amused at her slight mispronunciation of the word. "Well, we're going to the zoo today, guys. It was your turn to decide what we did last weekend. Besides, I heard they have a baby tree sloth." "Wouldn't you like to see that, a baby tree sloth? It sounds pretty awesome. Or maybe you're afraid of doing something pretty awesome." "No," Isby says. "No," Amelia says.
So that's Joe Mino reading from the beginning, a couple pages in, of The Great Perhaps, which was a New York Times editor's choice and quite an interesting book, both from the family dynamics and from the political backdrop. "It's what normal families do." That's a line that my wife and I use. And we act like normal people for a change. So that's kind of funny. I wondered about the Volvo, because it's become such a stereotype, the liberal Volvo drivers with their anti-war slogans on the back or bumper stickers on the back. Why that choice?
Well, Jonathan is a character who suffers from this very specific kind of epilepsy. And his epilepsy is triggered whenever he sees a cloud. And he's had it since he was a child, and he's on anti-seizure medication. But because of his own self-involvement and this pursuit of this squid, he oftentimes forgets to take his medicine, and so he'll faint in the middle of a presentation if he looks up and sees something that happens to be shaped like a cloud. And so the Volvo seemed like the safest car for someone who suffered from a fainting or seizures.
I wanted to ask you about Jonathan because it seems like he's going through a Job-like year and everything goes wrong for him at the same time. And it reminded me of the movie A Serious Man.
Oh, I love that. It was a great film.
You know, I didn't like it, actually.
Oh, really?
I didn't like it just because the stereotype of the whiny Jewish guy who can't stand up for himself as a Jewish guy drives me crazy.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So I couldn't get over that hurdle. But I have friends, Jewish friends, philosophers, who just thought it was great.
Yeah. I think there's something about the tone and the actor. You have to forgive me. I can't remember the actor's name. I know he's a stage actor and hasn't done too much film work. I thought he was just really, really sharp. And I think this question, you know, in the book, Jonathan is the father and there's the war going on in Iraq, and there's this election that they're all afraid of. And then there's his relationship with his wife is kind of falling apart, and his relationship with his children. His father has entered kind of the last phase of his life. And these questions, these ongoing catastrophes, seem like they're relegated to, you know, only certain moments. But when you step back, you realize, like, well, this is actually just part of the human condition. And one of the things that writing the book, I felt as I was studying and looking at 2004 and at these different events, you know, I started kind of pulling back a wider lens and realizing, well, this every 10 or 15 years, there's a moment like this in our country. And whether it's in the 70s when you look at Nixon and Watergate and the end of the Vietnam War, and even through the Carter administration, there still felt like there was this great upheaval and the Iran hostage crisis. And really, you know, like, and then things calm down for a couple of years, and then, you know, again, you have these large, almost catastrophic questions that we're asked to face. And so it's not limited to just a few months. And so, you know, the question in the book is, well, when these catastrophes rear up, how do you face them? Do you hide? Do you go and hide and
and try to build a fortress around yourself the way America seemed to do in that, you know, the first couple years after September 11th? Or do you try to face these conflicts? And that's the question of the book. Jonathan has all these different problems in his life, and he tries to hide from them about as long as he possibly can, and then ultimately he's forced to face them.
And he faces them in a, you know, he faces them, he kind of comes up to the hurdle, he backs off the hurdle, then he finally clears the hurdle.
Right.
He's like a balking horse in a way, or a balking well, lame horse.
Well, but, yeah, and I feel like that's my experience with life, right?
But even, you know, his marriage, he has been absent-minded about.
Yes.
Both, I think, because he traveled a lot looking for that giant squid.
Right.
And he understands finally that, you know, he's got to own up and apologize, and he rehearses an apology
right.
and can't deliver it the first time. But finally, screws up his courage and delivers it, which I thought was a nice way to go there toward the end.
Thanks.
I wanted to talk about this as an anti-war book, too, though, because Joe Mino in The Great Perhaps, you set it against not only, I mean, you do set it while the Iraq War is going and Bush is being reelected, but it's bigger than that.
Yes. Well, one of the books I went back to as I was writing the book, you know, I started writing and maybe I got like 100, 200 pages in, and these questions about the Iraq War were starting to come up, and that's when I wanted to have a kind of a longer or larger perspective. So one of the books I went directly to was Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse Five. One, for the tone and how he managed to deal with these huge, very dire questions, but with such humor and such inventiveness and such imagination. And I wanted to have some of that in the book. I didn't want it to be didactic or feel like, you know, as the narrator you're on this, or storyteller, you're on a soapbox where you have all these questions figured out. And I also wanted there to be humor. Because if anything, we learn, like, you know, that when these catastrophes do come up, humor seems like one of the ways we save ourselves, and that, you know, fundamentalists and people, followers of dogma, are oftentimes lacking in any kind of humor. And I think that speaks to their lack of appreciation for complexity, you know, and to appreciate the satire or the humor in a situation, you have to look at it in a larger kind of perspective. So, you know, I started looking at Slaughterhouse Five and how Vonnegut documented the firebombing of Dresden. And then I started doing research, and Henry Casper, who's Jonathan's father, who's been relegated to life in this nursing home in Chicago and who more than anything wants to escape, became a way for me to get at America's relationship to war over, you know, the last 60, 70 years. And so he happens to be the son of a German immigrant. And as I did this research, I realized that there were in Chicago and throughout Wisconsin a number of families, German and Italian, that were sequestered, that the FBI uprooted and then built a city for in a part of Texas called Crystal City. And they were held there from 1941, right after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, all the way till 47.
So this was analogous to the Japanese American internment camps.
It was. And, you know, that's, I think, been documented pretty well. I think in the 90s, right, they had a public apology to the families and survivors of that. But the German and Italian connection, I had never seen anything done about this in film. And I think the reason is because it contradicts this great story we've been telling ourselves for the last 50, 60 years about, you know, how as Americans we were incredibly brave and virtuous, and our conduct in the war was almost mythological. And you see it now, right, in film. HBO just has this new series, The Pacific, which to me almost borders on a kind of pornography.
I mean, you're going to have to spare me Tom Hanks,
yeah,
too.
I think Tom Hanks is a great actor, but I think... if we want to talk about war, then we need to talk about the actual reality of it. And, you know, through my research, I found that there was, you know, thousands of American citizens, children, families that were rounded up and held there for the duration of the war. And I think, you know, that speaks to our sense of fear and
yet, as the author of The Great Perhaps, you have Jonathan's father, the grandfather in the book, then go work for a armaments company?
Well, what happened is the research I found is a lot of these folks who grew up then in these internment camps, so kids whose parents and with them had been interned, actually went, a lot of them joined the army to prove that they were patriots, right? So if they were of enlistment age, they would actually join the army. So their family was being held on suspicion in Texas, but then they would join and serve at the end of World War II. And then a lot of them went on to different military careers. So Henry goes on to be an aeronautical designer. He really falls in love with the promise of flight. And you know, in the 50s and 60s, there was this interesting synthesis between airplane flight and rocket flight. And again, a lot of that was borrowed from German scientists who, after World War II, former Nazis who kind of joined our American space program, which is very interesting and questionable in different ways. So he begins working on this plane that eventually becomes the F-4 Phantom, which has a large role in the firebombing of Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And
so you have that as a backdrop. You have the University of Chicago working on the atom bomb.
That's right. So the University of Chicago is where the first ever controlled nuclear reaction happened. And now it's just a field. It's a grassy field. And
is there a plaque there or something?
There's not. There's actually a flame. There's a library, which is a couple hundred yards from the actual site. And there's this flame. I think it's called the immortal flame or the eternal flame, which to me is just bizarre and somewhat tasteless. And, you know, and a lot of those scientists, Enrico Fermi, who participated in that first reaction, I think were caught up in the momentum, and certainly there had to be some degree of ego involved in conquering this mystery or this question. And later, you know, Fermi, I think on his deathbed, realized what a terrible mistake that they had made. And so really, understanding America's relationship to war over the last half century through these different characters' lives, and how time and time again this sense of fear has unfortunately clouded our judgment and had grave implications at the time.
Yeah, and you quote Vonnegut at the beginning.
I do.
One of the great American tragedies is to have participated in a just war.
That's right. And, you know, when I went back and looked at Slaughterhouse-Five, there's this opening little prologue where someone asks him, "Mr. Vonnegut, what do you tell young writers who are interested in writing anti-war novels?" And his response is something has haunted me from the first time I read it, you know, in my early 20s, and I just reread it recently. And his answer is, "Well, I tell them writing an anti-war novel is about as useful as writing an anti-glacier novel." Mm-hmm. And it's chilling. I mean, that is a chill for someone who firsthand survived the firebombing of Dresden. To have that understanding that this is unfortunately part of something that defines us as human beings.
But I don't think he believed it. I hope he didn't.
I hope he did. I mean, he's held pretty closely, you know, to that belief that humans were capable of wonderful things, but at the same time creating these horrible machines that then carried out these kind of senseless acts. And, so that spirit, or at least that question of inevitability, is something that also makes its way throughout the book.
But the question I'm going to have to leave us with is, why in the world did he write it then?
Well, I guess, like, I mean, I'll just say that for writers, you know, for me at least, you sit down, you have a question in your life. This book was a question about what is going on in the country at this time. And the first audience is always yourself. You're trying to answer this question for yourself. And it ultimately leads only to more questions by the end.
Well, there are a lot of questions and some possible answers in The Great Perhaps by Joe Meno. That's M-E-N-O, and you can find him at joemeno.com, author of The Great Perhaps. Joe Meno, thanks for being my guest.
Thanks so much. It's such a pleasure. Thank you.
A lot of fun.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.